It is with great pleasure that I introduce our guests today. Whoa. Our guests today are Dr. Cheryl Crippen and Benjamin Odepol. Dr. Crippen is project director of the UCI Women and Children's Health and Well-Being Study, and Benjamin Odepol was born in Yimbo and is now Chief Technology Officer at Corona Norco Unified School District. They will share their experiences in a small community of friends helping to improve education, healthcare, microenterprise, and access to clean water in the village of Yimbo, Kenya. Please join me in welcoming Cheryl Crippen and Benjamin Odepol.
Okay, either or. One thing we're used to in Kenya is we kind of go with the flow and whatever works, whatever works. Thank you for having us here today. Can everyone hear me okay? I don't know if I'm between mics. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was raised in the United Methodist Church community, and very similar to the UU congregation from what I've seen, there's a very strong focus on issues of social justice. And is it better if I move away from here? And along with my parents who are here in the audience today, they're two of the guests that snuck past reception, so hello mom and dad. Along with them, that community really instilled a sense of responsibility and in a greater way, a sense of obligation to use the privileges that we have, be it economic or educational or nationality, to further and move towards the goals, the greater goals of equality and social justice. And that sense of responsibility that I've been instilled with, and that sense of pay it forward, that is shared by many Africans that I've met as well. A lot of times we think that, you know, people in the Western world are the ones that have this perception of helping and pay it forward. But this is absolutely shared by my Kenyan brother, Benjamin, who's going to be speaking with me today, as well as like I said, the entire Odepol family and many, many Africans that I've met. So I wanted to focus this morning a little bit on the evolution of sort of my thinking about social justice. In particular, how working towards social justice in Africa has evolved and how my sort of conceptualization of social justice has really been informed by my 2+ decades of experience of working in Africa, or what I call my relationship with Africa, for better or for worse. And that journey, I sort of think of it in 4 distinct phases that I've transitioned through over the past, like I said, 2 decades. So the first phase was when I was an exchange student at the University of Nairobi. As an undergraduate, I was studying international relations, and like any good international relations major, I had that strong idealism that I was going to go and, you know, save the world one continent at a time, starting with Africa. And the year was 1990, and for those of you that recall, that was just an amazing time to be in Kenya, specifically Africa in general. 2 weeks after I arrived in Kenya, Nelson Mandela was freed from prison. And it was just such an amazing time of hope and idealism. Because Mandela, for me and for many people, is just emblematic of the struggle for social justice. And to be there at that time was simply amazing. And I befriended someone named Charlie Odepol, older brother of Benjamin. I met Benjamin as well. Benjamin wasn't quite in college at that point. And Charlie was a sociology major, and we had many discussions, like many undergraduates do, the sociology major from Kenya and the international relations major from the United States, many discussions about politics and world injustices and how, you know, things were messed up and how we were going to make them right, you know, like with the confidence that any good undergraduates have. And what quickly emerged and what was fascinating to me, you know, because I thought, you know, I had a very liberal training and liberal arts background and politically liberal and all that, how different our perspectives were, because I thought we were sort of on the same page, you know, fighting the cause and what have you. And our perspectives of what the problems were in Africa and what the corresponding solutions would be there for in Africa were vastly different, vastly different. So, for example, my training, my brief training at that point, really led me to believe that the problems were one of Western neglect.
So in other words, that 1985 Ethiopian famine that many of you remember, we saw the images, is one that would be resolved by sending aid, sending assistance, humanitarian relief. So the civil wars and the civil strife in Africa, the solution would be humanitarian peacekeeping missions and et cetera, et cetera. So the problem to me was one of lack of advocacy in Africa, lack of assistance, and lack of Western involvement. And Charlie's like, oh, Cheryl, you've been in Kenya for a month. I'm like, right, and I've been studying it in school. He's like, no, the problem, as a sociology major from the University of Nairobi could speak to, is one of Western involvement. It's not one of Western neglect. In fact, it's the exact opposite. He says, what you're seeing as these problems are the consequence of a post-colonial era of exploitation and oppression that has absolutely contributed to these things that we see going on now. And these civil wars that you see going on, that your solution is send some peacekeeping missions, these are proxy wars that are being fought by the United States and the Soviet Union, then Soviet Union. And these dictators that are causing all these problems in Africa, the Mobutus and this and that, those are being propped up by the United States. Well, this is rather awkward, right? So, you know, his thought was Africa's problems will be solved by Africans and not by foreigners. Now, I'm paraphrasing because that was actually P.W. Botha that said that in 1985 in response to international calls to end apartheid. But that was very much Charlie's opinion, that it's not you all to come in and fix our problems. Africa's problems need to be solved by Africans. And I will never forget him telling me on a train ride from Mombasa to Nairobi, and if you've ever been to Kenya, they're very long train rides. He said, you know, you think, you being the United States, not just me, because when you travel, you realize quickly that you're the spokesperson for your entire country, right? He says, you think that you're the police of the world. And that sense of obligation and responsibility that you know, liberal do-gooders have. And Charlie and I are, you know, best friends. So he's saying this in a way that only a best friend can say that. He said that sense of obligation and responsibility is very paternalistic. And in a sense, that's the same attitude that colonial powers had that left Africa so ill-equipped to deal with the transition to Western-style democracy during the independence period. So I went home and I ruminated on that for about 4 or 5 years and obtained another degree. And I returned what I think of as phase two to East Africa, this time Uganda, as a lecturer, a political science lecturer at Makerere University, and as a consultant for the U.S. Agency for International Development. And as I was teaching international relations to Ugandan undergraduates, and again, this is what I think of as phase two of my thinking about social justice and how best to achieve it, it became very evident to me that my perceptions of social justice were very much a function of my lived experience in the context I was living in. So in 1994, most of you will remember, was when the Rwandan genocide happened, and 1 million people were killed in 100 days. And that, in 1994, barely made a blip in the U.S. media, I remember. And at the same time, shortly thereafter, so then June of 1994, two people were murdered, and that captured U.S. attention for the next year and a half, which was the O.J. Simpson trial. And I'm not, you know, this is sort of beyond the scope of what I was going to talk about today, but it was very incongruent. And to be teaching international relations in Uganda and having to, you know, kind of reconcile the priorities and the attention was very troublesome for me. Later in the academic year, 1995, we had the Oklahoma bombing. And as an international relations professor, I was teaching and talking a lot about the construction of terrorism and what is a terrorist versus a freedom fighter, right? Some people think Nelson Mandela is a freedom fighter. Other people say he's a terrorist. Same thing with the Contras, et cetera, et cetera. The Oklahoma bombing occurs. We talk what's nationalism versus patriotism. Right? Well, it depends on your point of view. So Oklahoma bombing occurs in 1995. I think it was around April, if I'm correct. And again, those of you may remember, the first perceptions of what that was a terrorist bombing, terrorist looking like an Islamic terrorist somewhere from the Middle East, dark person bombing or people bombing the Oklahoma Trade Center. So we were talking in my class about what that might mean, and why is it that people in the Middle East might have such strong feelings about killing people in the U.S., blah, blah, blah. And then what happens the next week, you get the cover of the International Newsweek, and who's on the front cover? Blonde hair, blue-eyed Tim McVeigh. So you get all these incongruencies, right? Homegrown terrorism. And simultaneously, I was consulting on the USAID, on a USAID project, integrating health services, because I had my freshly minted master's degree, right? And I was going to be hired by USAID to work in development. And I thought, this is great. I can use my degree. I can help people. And what I found in working for USAID, like, isn't this interesting? There's all these Americans getting paid a lot of money. I mean, I was getting paid a reasonable amount of money, but I was getting paid a U.S. salary. A U.S. salary in Uganda is a ton of money. And all these U.S. expatriates working for USAID had drivers, had domestic help, had cooks, right? I'm not exact, right? Right, Benjamin? And I'm thinking, this is really weird because this is a lot of money. This is a very expensive way to do development, because any one of my undergraduates at Makerere University, my Ugandan undergraduates, could have done these jobs. I'm like, what? What's going on? Why? Well, as it turns out, USAID has restricted funding, and when USAID has a budget, they have to hire U.S. workers first, use U.S. technology, use U.S. parts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought to myself, that really seems to not encourage sustainable development. In fact, that might even seem to perpetuate dependency, because when the funding dries up as administrations change and staffing have to then leave and change, the people in the community are kind of left high and dry. So I'm like, that doesn't really make sense. That seems like a very expensive way to do development. And it seemed like there was a big gap between over who has ownership over these types of development projects versus is it this welfare model and this handout. So I became really discouraged and kind of hopeless. Like, what's the point? This was my chosen career, development. And I'm seeing this doesn't really even seem, not only is it a failure, but it just seems like there's real no point. So when I returned to the U.S., I started a career in international education, which was predicated on the fact that, okay, empowering people through educational opportunities and cross-cultural exchanges. And my then-husband and I sponsored Charlie, Benjamin's older brother, to come to the U.S. to do graduate training, because I thought, well, we're going to encourage Kenyans and or Ugandans to get education, to go back and to pursue development. That would be sort of the way to help facilitate development. And we sponsored a single mother in Uganda and her children to get secondary education in Uganda. Uganda's a fee-based K-12 program. And I worked in international education, developing bilateral exchanges between the United States and Africa to facilitate university students going back and forth. Again, predicated on the fact, like, okay, as people get to know people, my people, kumbaya. So then I had another sort of reality check, because Charles now, but he'll always be Charlie to me. He obtained his doctorate degree. He's now practicing as a clinical psychologist. He lives in Sacramento. Otherwise, he'd be here today, too. It'd be much fun, wouldn't it? And he sponsored his brother, Benjamin, who came here, studied IT, and now has a master's degree and is head of technology for a school district. But what happens is they come here and they get education, but the job opportunities in the U.S. are exponentially higher than they are in Kenya. So it's problematic to get education here, then go back to Kenya and find a job to help support your family and to give back to your community. And what happens with Benjamin and Charlie, which is what happens to many international students, they come here, they fall in love, they get married, they start a family, they become expatriates. And I thought, uh-oh, did I inadvertently contribute to this brain drain that doesn't necessarily help development? Well, in reality, my thinking now is that Kenyan expatriates, or expatriates in general, are the cornerstone of development in Africa, in Kenya. And so just as a way to transition and hand it over to Benjamin, my phase four thinking is that community-based development really cannot occur without decision-making occurring at the local level. Okay, I think that's a given. Like the United States, Kenya is a very pluralistic society. It's very diverse. It's not homogeneous. It's not one size fits all. So the communities have to be empowered to make decisions to say, these are our priorities, not what USAID thinks is a priority. This is what we live here. These are our needs. But we also know that the resources to facilitate some of those aren't really going to come from the local level. So the current water project that we're working on is a $60,000 project. So we have community buy-in. We were directed by the community. This is the need. But that community does not have $60,000. The government is not willing to put up $60,000 for a rural community in Kenya, the government of Kenya. But the people are committed to saying, we will either provide money or each family will provide money or labor to facilitate this. It's just not in the scope of $60,000. So the resources have to come from some kind of global level to facilitate community-based priorities. But the piece that I think has always been missing, and this is what our hybrid model is there needs to be some kind of cultural broker, a go-between, between the donor agencies or the resources and the local community. And that's where I see a big need or a big gap that's been unmet, and that's where I see the expatriate community to facilitate that. It cannot be the ivory tower or academia. It cannot be U.S. expatriates. Can't be UN agencies and what have you. It has to be the local community mediated by expats that are familiar and know all of the rules and know the people, etc. So in 2007, Charlie and Benjamin founded Friends of Yimbo. And again, they're Kenyan brothers from the community. And the premise was is that we're going to harness the resources and use the privileges that we have, having been educated now, having graduate degrees, having a global network of friends and family, we're going to harness those resources and contribute back to our home community. And the Friends of Yimbo consists of 8 advisory board members. We're all very diverse backgrounds. None of us are professional fundraisers. None of us are public speakers. We're a little scrappy group, actually, and we're still kind of small. But what makes it really amazing, I think, and unique is that we're connected through friendship and family. And all projects are initiated by the actual local community in Yimbo. There's a village committee that is slated for each project. So right now we have a water access to clean water project. And again, that was designated as a high priority because, yes, education important. We built a library, that's important. We provided school uniforms, important. But until clean water is provided, women and school-aged children are still, you guys have probably all heard this, walking 3 miles a day to get water. Water's heavy, water that's time-consuming, and then they have to come back and boil and filter it. That takes 3 or 4 hours out of the day. That means some school-age kids cannot attend school because of the cost of doing this. So that alone frees up women's time to pursue microenterprise. It frees up kids' time to go to school, etc. To us, it seems like a very simple project, but to them, completely unattainable. A $60,000 three-mile pipe? Totally out of reach. And so the other piece that we do is we sponsor annual humanitarian trips, again, linking donors and people in the United States and internationally to the local community to facilitate cross-cultural exchange and getting to know people at the individual level as opposed to just having this model of, oh, we're giving you this. So there's community buy-in and what have you. So I want to transition to Benjamin now and have him talk a little bit more about the community and his journey and his family's experience in Yimbo.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you for inviting us this morning to share really what we do, our story, much of which Cheryl has shared, and really why it is fun for us to do what we do, and we just keep on going down this road, and we more people join us. Today, I'd like to sort of talk about what I call my little talk I call little things in life. There are many little things we overlook in life, and oftentimes in our lives, we focus on the things we do not have. We talk about the things that are not perfect, and the ones that could be better. I do the same all the time. But I've learned to adapt to very different scenarios, very different environments, especially compared to 8,000 miles away in Kenya coming to this environment. So what I've learned is to appreciate those little things that I encounter, those little things that I learn every day from each and every one of you. Our father, Joseph Oedipo, taught us how to appreciate the little things, and it has taken many years for us in our family and most of our siblings after he's gone to sort of reflect and apply those lessons that we learned from him. And much like innovation, one may make a contribution to so many things that they themselves never enjoy. We often hear about people who come up with inventions that help others in faraway lands, whether it's medicines, technology. So similarly, my father, Joseph, thought about building a school in Yimbo that would help the local children in the village. And not necessarily his own children who went to the schools either in a small town or far away from the village, because he had jobs where he moved around. So whenever he drove down that dirt road that now some of our friends know too well if you go to the village, is he would see all these children walking 3 miles to school, and some of them as young as 5 years old. And what he would do is stop by, always loved children, stop by and tell them to get in his blue 1975 Chevy pickup, and he'd drive them to school whenever he could, and then get on his way to do his business. And if he was coming back, he would do the same. But he vowed to get them a school closer to the village, because that was heartbreaking to him to see all those kids trekking every day and doing the same things that Cheryl talked about. They would come back home, and in the evening, they would do their chores up until 10 o'clock at night, and the cycle would start again. So one day, what he did was he went to a friend of his who was from India, and they went to school together. And the friend owned a hardware store, and he asked his friend, and this is in our hometown, Kisumu, which is about 30 miles from where the actual village is. And so he asked his friend if he could get some materials, building materials, on credit. And his friend said, sure. So he loaded them on the pickup, drove all the way back to Yimbo, delivered them in Yimbo, and he carved out a piece of his own land and said, I want everybody here tomorrow at 8 o'clock, we're building a school. And this will be our school. And so that school is what we refer to as Muguna Primary School that we've been supporting the last 4 years. And so really in the words of, the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there's no path and leave a trail. So we're all different and we have all different motivations to help others. There's a short story here about a man named Edward Gonzalez. Edward was a store clerk in New York, and he was waiting for subway one cold winter morning. And this was last year. And so as he was waiting, he saw someone stuck in the rails. And he jumped quickly, instinctively, and helped the man. And later on, you know, news crew got wind of it, and they came and interviewed him. And the first question was, as the press would do, stick the microphone in your face, and said, so why did you help that man? Why did you just jump in and help? And Edward looked at him and said, well, I just didn't want to miss work because it was time and a half on Saturdays. So, moral of the story is, whatever your motivation is to help others, it's okay, it makes a contribution. So, if your motivation is to travel the world, that's a great thing, to see many things out there in the world, it's a great thing. If it is always to see beautiful Kenya, like Cheryl did many years ago, and many of you probably have, and help a village get clean water, even better. We welcome you to join us every year we go, and it will fulfill whatever your motivation is. Friends of Yimbo to us is a celebration of our parents, as much as it is about the efforts of all our friends. When I look back, and sometimes I do get a little teary, I think of it as 21 years. I only had 21 years with my dad. But some of you even shorter with your loved ones. But I've come to realize it's not the amount of time, rather than the quality of time shared. And this is why I'm grateful for the little things that he shared with us. Just like my father used to say, there are no guarantees in life on what I can leave behind for my family when I'm gone. But at least I can model to you the type of connections you need to make with others you share this world with. And that was his moral, his motto, and that's how he went about his life. And it is so for that same reason that he was reluctant to connect us to his childhood friends who were in influential places when we were ready to find jobs. He would say, it is an easy way out to do so, but you need to build your own connections because it will mean much more to you and pay dividends time and time again. And I must say, even though at the time reluctantly, but today I must say he was right. Because there have been many connections we have made, and you are a testament to that today as well. And those connections continue to build. And so just as California embraced Charles, myself, and now my two sisters, it's the same way we share the YIMBO with you. Because we now have a connection. And you have friends in another part of the world. And yes, we all must leave a trail. And the little things that he taught us are the real driving force for us to do what we do. You are now really friends of YIMBO from this point on. And YIMBO will welcome you any day you show up. And I want to thank you for your listening today and your generosity. And may it pay dividends time and time again. So thank you.
You've presented a very promising new way to aid in development. However, there's one concern that I'm sure people will have, and that is whenever you funnel a large amount of money through one family, you create a lot of a concentration of power in a community. It can be abused, you know, through commissions or other manner. How can you ensure that the money is well used?
Well, good question. One of the things, that's why we got a very diverse board. Our advisory board really has people from really diverse backgrounds, like Cheryl said. A lot of people that will bring in independent auditors for us will have advisors to do all kinds of things to make sure that everything is transparent. But the main thing about the family involvement into the village has been ensuring that there's somebody that can directly speak to the village. My mom, who still lives in Kenya, sits on the board, and she has a committee in the village that ensures that things are driven, or the requests are driven through that committee in the village before it gets to us. So that way, we have that sort of balance of power between the local committee and the committee that sits out here. We're just the driving force to get to the village. And so that's what we try to ensure, that we are not custodians of anything. All we do is we want to just make sure that we open the doors to the village so people know the story, and then everything that happens channels through the advisory board and then the local committee in Kenya.
There has been similar to what has happened through in places like South Africa, where there's been national reconciliation. They have tried to follow that sort of model in trying to make sure there's national healing. Number one, the big change was there is now a coalition government. So the previous president that supposedly did not win the election, and the other contender have now come in as a coalition government. So that's number one. There was at least instant peace, and the violence stopped. And by the way, our first trip was scheduled for 2007, and we had to cancel it for that reason. So that was the first thing. So the second most important thing that has happened in the country that we are really hopeful for also as an organization is they passed a new constitution. There was an amendment to the constitution, so it limits the powers of the executive, and it gives more power to the people. So that is now going on. That same constitution is now being implemented. And they have, Kenyans have actually seen the fruits of a strong constitution. The president can no longer unilaterally make appointments and say that is the way we're going to go with that. Recently, he tried to make an appointment for the Chief Justice for the Supreme Court, and the parliament kicked it back. And they had to go through the process, and they appointed somebody that had gone through some vetting, or amongst a group that had gone through some vetting. So we see that change coming in. And it's actually a very exciting time for people in Kenya. So right now, things really are in a good position, and it's just, it will take time to really get to the point where there's complete stability as we see a change in leadership.
I think one of the biggest things with USAID is that the change in staffing is contingent, predicated on the administration. And it seems like USAID should be one of those organizations that regardless of who's in power, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat president, it seems like there should be some continuity among developmental agencies. And USAID is one of those. They are political appointments. And I think that's probably one of the number one troublesome things. It seems like if one thing could be improved straight off the bat, it would be to have some continuity with staffing. So the policies are consistent, the funding is a little more fluid, when there's a project to see it through, and then clearly training of the goal of USAID should always be very, very short term. You get in, you provide support, you train the local community, and you get out. The goal to me should be teaching people how to fish, is that how the analogy goes, as opposed to doing the fishing for people and giving them the fish. I think I have that totally wrong, but yeah, something like that. But something about that type of sustainable development. And unfortunately, because it's a political organization, there's a lot of good things that USAID does do. I'm not saying it's a completely, wasted case, but that the changing of staff with administration is very problematic, and changing of policies depending on. So we're going to not fund this country because they have birth control programs that also may have abortion. So then that's like no funding for that country. Those types of policies are a little bit problematic, and they tend to be politically tied. Development in an ideal world should not have political implications, I guess.
I'm not sure. Just as a comment to the comment, I suppose, is one of the things that got me so overwhelmed working in development, and of course now I work in psychiatry, which is a whole other thing, was that it just seemed so overwhelming. Like, just not just the continent of Africa, but the world is sort of a mess in a lot of ways. And I think once I moved into studying of psychology, I sort of shifted my focus to one person at a time. Like, I'm not going to save the world. I'm going to accept that. I'm not in college anymore. I've kind of shifted from that, like, well, if I can help this one person, or by broad extension, this village, that's okay. So I, at least in my own mind, I've sort of shifted from, as much as I can out, like, here's what we need to do, I don't have the power to do that. I don't have the power to change, global relations or the sovereign nations, no power. But what I can do, or what we feel like we can do, I mean, we feel like we're very humbled. And that's why we kind of keep ourselves small, because, well, we can do this. And anything beyond that to me is just so overwhelming, And so we'll have discussions and what have you, but in the end, to me, it's almost, well, it's cocktail conversation, because we're not empowered to change at that level.
And just to make an additional comment, one of the model that we try to use when we got together as a group, certainly, it started with Charles and I, my brother, is to look at, definitely, we look at what's happening in the village of Greenville. But broadly, also to kind of start the discussions that Charles and Cheryl had, spanning the countrywide, was some of the things we saw, we realized were, if you don't start with the basics, then it's hard to address the larger problem. So, if you look at the way we have done our progress has been since 2007. One of the first things we thought about was, we don't want to go to the village and do one project, because of course you're small and you don't have a lot of resources. We don't want to do one project and then be gone, and then they say, oh, here we go again. Somebody always comes towards saying they're going to do X, Y, Z, and they're gone, which happens quite a bit. A lot of organizations come in, and like Cheryl said, it's overwhelming. And they realize pretty soon they don't have sustainable resources to continue on year after year. So the first thing we did was we did something that we thought would be symbolic. We talked to them. Of course, their needs were in the areas of water mainly and health. And we said, how about we start something with the school, which was a library, and that library has become a community center. So that library, even though a few of them looked at it and said, okay, but it's just a school. It's not addressing the larger community. Well, what has turned out is that library now has books, because we built it in 2007, and three groups have gone successively, have bought textbooks and reading books, and we've carried some books that are relevant that we put in the library. The kids take the books home, and the parents are now reading. Not that they'll ever be reading at the level we want it to be, but the parents are looking at those books with their kids, which is very important. The reason why we see there's a big change now from 2007 to where we are today is the teacher, one of the teachers of the schools, the Laguna Primary School, said this year when she took the group of kids to a debating competition at the provincial level, which is at the state level comparatively, she says the kids were very confident. She says they did not say every word I really wanted them to say, but they were confident because they have a book to read. And so they remember, they will at least make phrases out of the books that they read, and those are the little steps we wanted to make. And now we have a really nice relationship with the community. Now as we're building on to the next thing, which was their first priority, which is water, they have some confidence that things will change. At least things will change. And they're working through committees. I think that's the most important thing. As you're saying, how do we change this community and successfully change other communities? This water project actually is a combined effort of two villages. So it's been registered locally and under the local government in the name of two villages, another village called Almuena. So these two villages, what they're doing is we're saying this is the model that we want you to get together, talk about your projects, and as you talk about your projects, everybody must have a buy-in and use that model wherever you want to go. If you want to use it 10 miles from this place, great. But this is not a Friends of Yuma way of doing things. It's just a model that if it works elsewhere, please use it by all means. Good question. And sometimes this is why I get into trouble with my wife, because I spend a lot of my time doing this and a lot of our money doing this. And she says, hey, but you know we've got to do X, Y, Z. Well, we use 99% of the money, between 98 and 99% of the money towards directly to the village. A lot of our money, Charles and I and a lot of the advisory committee, a lot of the money has gone into this since we started. Because we just do what we need to do. And that's what Basicon has driven us. We do what we need to do, and we take the money, and we say we agree on the projects, and the Yuma communities have submitted. If it's a small project, for example, if we have 2,000 in the kitty, so we say, okay, what's our priority list looking like? Well, there's the uniforms project that needs $1,500, and we just take it directly to that project, and we spend it that way, and it goes directly. All of us are volunteers. So the money, that 1% that I'm talking about, it could be either postage or it could be material. For example, we printed a program for our last fundraiser. Those would be the things we would spend the money on. The rest of it, transportation, we are in two different cities. Some of us are here in Southern California, and the rest of us are in Northern California. We go up and down, we fly back up and down. It's all from our pockets. So it is 100% volunteer at this point.
And that's what makes it, in some ways, very labor intensive, but that's where we can also ensure that the biggest bang for the buck goes to the community. Because who wants to contribute to an organization where 50% right off the top goes to administration? But the flip side of that is that we also have to stay kind of small potatoes, because we are not professional fundraisers. We're not hiring professional fundraisers. We all do it our own selves, so sometimes we're a little scrappy, and sometimes we're a little maybe not as professional as it might look otherwise. but all of our, you know, we have zero overhead costs, zero. The only thing that we actually pay for right now that's a relatively little bit of an expense is a tax attorney so we can make sure that we're in compliance with U.S. tax law. Because nonprofits, the laws change, so that's really our only expense. And so we're actually pretty proud of that. But it also means that we have to stay kind of small. And we pay for our own transportation. I mean, the board members all kind of pay their own way and contribute.